Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassai and I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, we'll be grasshopping not from lawn to lawn, but from city to province. We'll tell you about Truth and Reconciliation Day, also about what went on across the country during last week's sexual orientation and gender identity SOGI protests.
You know, I've heard from different people in the past who are part of the protest group that were trying to turn children to being gay. It's nonsense.
I don't like seeing what's happening in our educational system with the sexualization of our children. I just don't think it's the job of the school to be interfering with the children's training like that. They're there to teach the kids education.
And this is just division, pure and simple.
It worries me in what the ultimate agenda is.
September 30th marks a Truth and Reconciliation Day across the country, a time to reflect on the past, but also to create a better future for Indigenous peoples. We'll go to BC and New Brunswick.
On Truth Reconciliation Day, we need to be sure that we pay attention to the truth. So in us sharing the history as well as sharing what had happened to Indigenous people and looking at our resiliency and all the stuff that we can survive and have survived and will survive, it's always good to understand that this is going to be a partnership between Canada and Indigenous people within the local territories. And I think the first step that people can utilize to become a good ally and to help that process of reconciliation is become a strong ally is by learning as much as you can about the local people and the territory you're on.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Thanks for keeping us company. We start things off with the anti-SOGI protests that were held last week across Canada on September 20th. The Million March for Kids national protest took place in 33 cities and towns in Ontario and in 101 places in Canada, from major cities to small towns. The purpose of the protest was to support the elimination of the SOGI curriculum, pronouns, gender ideology, and mixed bathrooms in schools. We had time last week to take a quick peek at the stories produced by our journalists, but we now have the opportunity to do so again this week. Our reporters based in many Canadian cities were there. We'll hear from Kingston, Montreal, Nanaimo, Toronto, Peterborough, and Vernon, BC. We start off in Montreal, where the anti-SOGI education protesters faced off with hundreds of supporters of the queer community just outside McGill's University's rotted gates. The result was a rush standoff lasting until the early afternoon, with the two groups separated by Montreal police. Drag queen Uma God was there to lend support to queer and especially trans people who have become a culture war issue in recent years. Anti-SOGI protesters played the Canadian anthem and held coordinated signs with slogans like "Say No to Gender Indoctrination" and "I Belong to My Parents." This from Jules Bugel in Montreal.
Wednesday's protest was one of many across Canada. Under the banner of the 1 Million March for Children, protesters demanded schools drop discussion of sexual orientation and gender identity from their curricula.
Don't impose your ideology. Education, not sexualization.
Drag queen Uma God was there to lend support to queer, but especially trans people, whose very existence has become a culture war issue in recent years.
I'm old enough to remember a time when, you know, trans wasn't even a word that most people knew. And so now we've come so far, I can't let us go backwards. I'm using my voice, using the platform that I have, the friends that I have, the community that we have, to make sure that everyone knows that whether you're in a big city like Montreal or a tiny little village of 250 people, you have a voice. We're here for each other.
Many of the people there asked to remain anonymous. One such protester suggested a degree of tolerance for what people do in private, but said teaching acceptance was a bridge too far.
They are really free to do whatever they want, and we are really free to do whatever we want. But there is a line, thin line between these two, let's say, categories. They cannot come and impose messages and way of thinking and everything. They have to accept us, and we have to accept them.
In Kingston, Ontario, the 1 million March protesters gathered in front of City Hall around 9 a.m. They were met directly across the street at the same time in Confederation Park by Kingston's 2S LGBTQIA+ community and allies, who responded with a counter-protest approximately twice the size of the opposing crowd. At the peak of the protest, approximately 150 protesters and 300 counter-protesters were present. In Kingston, Ontario, here's a bit of what Kristen O'Leary came back with.
It's just been really, you know, beautiful to see this, and everybody here, you know, nobody's the same, everybody's different, but we're all kind of, you know, here to support each other.
I think the energy here is really mixed. I think there's a lot of sadness on our side of the road, that we're at this place again and again and again. There's certainly a lot of energy to push back and just show that we're a strong group of people who are not going to be silenced, and we are supporting our children and other people's children to express themselves and be themselves.
Our side is having way much more fun than that side, it appears to me.
Counter-protesters also shared some of their reasons for attending.
I'm on the GAN Pride Alliance committee and had to be here to support the whole 2S LGBTQ community and my friends, and just say that hate has no home here. And this is just division, pure and simple.
We're lesbians, and we have friends who have trans and queer kids. And
I have two kids and a grandson. And
we want them to be free to express themselves and be supported in their choices.
Anti-Soji protests in Nanaimo were also outnumbered by several hundred pro-LGBTQ activists who staged their counter-protests in various locations across the city. The protest started in front of the School District 68 building, where a handful of anti-Soji protesters, one with a sign equating the program with eugenics and pedophilia, were drowned out by counter-protesters chanting while waving homemade signs and rainbow flags. This excerpt from Mick Sweetman in Nanaimo, BC. He's speaking with school superintendent Scott Saywell, followed by an anti-Soji protester.
The idea that people can't be who they are is a dangerous ideal, and it's just fueled by hate. And, you know, I've heard from different people in the past who are part of the protest group that we're trying to turn children to being gay. It's nonsense. Any curriculum or education in schools is sharing the idea that children are who they are and they're accepted and loved.
This is categorically not opposed to the LGBTQ movement. Nobody has any problems with any adults identifying whatever, however they so wish. This really is a matter to do with children. That, again, many people on the conservative side of this issue feel that children are innocent and they shouldn't be introduced to concepts about sexuality until they reach the age of sexual maturity around 12, 13 years of age.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
And in the most populated Canadian city, Toronto, hundreds converged at Queen's Park against the 1 million March for Kids. Large groups of protesters for and against the sexual orientation and gender identity curriculum flanked the Legislative Assembly early in the morning. Some of the protesters held People's Party of Canada PPC signs saying "Leave our kids alone," and homemade signs saying things such as "Parents know best" and "No sex ed." The march was quickly met by opposition. A counter-protest organized by a group called the 519 was held at the same time. In Toronto, Owen Thompson spoke with a counter-protester, Jane Church.
This is what unity looks like. This is what unity looks like.
I brought my little baby with me, and I think it's important because children are going to be who they're going to be. And, you know, the protesters on the north side of the building, I think, just want to control kids. And ultimately, kids, you can't control kids. They're just going to be who they want to be, and we should support them to do that and protecting their rights over parental rights.
And so you said you brought your kids here today. So why is it important to bring your children here?
I think it's important to show the protesters that people with children can also be on the side of you know, trans rights and LGBTQ rights. And also, parental rights are not a thing. You don't have rights over your kids. That's, like, not how human rights work. But I don't think that's the view of the protesters on the other side.
And now to Vernon, B.C., where approximately 400 anti-Soji protesters were met by a small crowd of 20 counter-protesters. Our reporter Megan Dooling says that Soji has been used since 2016 in B.C. schools. It gives teachers and students language to talk about sexuality and gender. She first met up with Bob and Pat Jennings at the anti-Soji rally.
My name's Bob Jennings, and I'm just here protesting because I don't like seeing what's happening in our educational system with the sexualization of our children.
What do you see happening?
I see a lot of the materials and so on that are being handed out to the kids that I just don't agree with. I don't think that's the school's job. I think it's the parents' job.
And what kind of material are you seeing?
The books on teaching kids about masturbation and the mix-up of the genders and so on, I don't agree with. Just don't think it's the job of the school to be interfering with the children's training like that. They're there to teach the kids education.
And do you have trans people in your life who you talk to about this?
No. I have talked to lots of people. I know lots of gay people. They don't offend me in the least. I just don't think it's the thing to be teaching our children.
Well, my name's Pat, and I'm not against the gays at all. I just feel that the children need to be taught by the parents, not taught stuff at school and then told them not to tell the parents. That's not right.
And I hear all the, turned on CBC Radio on the way in this morning, and all they were talking about us all as a hate group, and this has nothing to do with hate whatsoever. We're not hating anybody. We're just trying to protect our children.
Megan Dooling also gave voice to some of the counter-protesters. "We're here to protect the children," said the elderly couple who don't have children in school and who don't know any transgendered people.
"We're doing a counter-protest to the protest against teaching LGBTQ safe curriculum in schools. We support, obviously, maintaining a safe space for LGBTQ two-spirit kids in our schools. So, yeah.
Not just the children, but the parents and the teachers, too.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I'm a parent of a non-binary child. I'm a trans woman myself. And it's like, when I went to school, forget me ever coming out. I would have been dead. I would have just gotten beaten to death one way or another. So it's like, I'd rather see them have a safe space where they're acknowledged and they can get their message out, which is part of what the Soji is about, is getting their message out to their classmates. It's not just the teachers or the administration. It's the kids being able to talk about who they are. And so, I mean, forcing the children to be outed to their parents when they haven't done it because it's not safe is a mistake.
And our last stop now, the city of Peterborough, Ontario, also saw some action as protesters gathered around 9 a.m. in front of the Peterborough City Hall. Stephanie Young is an active ally and advocate for the 2S LGBTQ plus community and a parent to a gender diverse Peterborough High School student. She spoke with Edward Sweeney a week after the protest about her concerns.
My child, as you said, is a grade 9 student here at a local high school. They are part of the LGBT community. My role as a parent is just to support my child and really every child in the community. My first reaction was, I guess, in a way, I was proud that they had the confidence and they knew that their father and I would love them no matter what, and that they felt safe enough to tell us who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm already getting quite emotional.
That's okay.
It really, to me, is a scary world when people can't be who they are. It's really a gamut of emotions for me. I'm sad that people have to counter-protest. I'm proud to be one of the counter-protesters. I'm proud to be an ally, regardless of where my child falls. I feel like I would do it no matter what. There is some genuine fear. The protesters are very loud and maybe not always physically aggressive, but definitely verbally aggressive. And they're typically white men of a certain age who have a pretty physical presence. And if I'm afraid as a cis woman, I can only imagine how members of the community, how fearful they might be. I mean, when you're going after the whole education system, it's really frightening, and it worries me in what the ultimate agenda is. It's just about silencing anyone who doesn't believe in these extreme views. And I'm really concerned as a parent and just a member of the community. Like, we seem to have made a lot of progress, and that progress is being attacked in such a visceral way that I don't really understand.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca.
And we now change subjects to talk about Truth and Reconciliation Day in Canada. Celebrations have been held before and around the official date of September 30th across the country. And our journey towards truth and reconciliation begins in Prince George, British Columbia, with a conversation between our journalist Ian Craig and a local Indigenous counselor who speaks of reconciliation and truth ahead of this year's National Day. Kleditane First Nation counselors Joshua Seymour will be attending the public ceremony and private healing gathering on Kleditane territory this September 30th. Counselor Josh Seymour reminds us that among many things, the purpose of Truth and Reconciliation Day is to honor those who survived residential schools. The day serves as an opportunity to take the time to acknowledge and reflect upon our shared history. Here's part of Ian Craig's conversation with Joshua Seymour in Prince George, BC.
It's one of those events that it'll be a solemn event, kind of like Remembrance Day, just based on the situation around where Truth and Reconciliation Day came from. But it's also good to remember that when we look at things in our past, kind of like the residential schools and all the other cultural genocide, that is not actually Indigenous history. It's Canadian in history of the church. When we look at history from a perspective from an Indigenous person, Canada's history plays a small role within Indigenous history, whereas Indigenous history plays a small role within Canadian history, but Indigenous history goes all the way back to the beginning of time.
Clearly, culture has obviously existed on this territory since time immemorium. Are there certain protocols and practices that have been developed over time that we should be thinking about and acknowledging, perhaps not just specifically on this weekend of September 30th, but perhaps all the time while we're on this territory and coming together to think about what has happened here on this land?
Yeah, when we look at, especially with Truth and Reconciliation Day and understanding that there was an attempt to basically eradicate Indigenous people, and on Truth and Reconciliation Day, we need to be sure that we pay attention to the truth, which would be the historical content of what had happened with the Canadian government and the churches to Indigenous people. But also understanding that Truth and Reconciliation Day is to honor the people who did survive those of the residential schools. We're there to honor them, because without them, no other Indigenous people would be here. And I think that's where, you know, the direction of Truth and Reconciliation Day should be focused, is to thank people who have survived residential school and for pushing the protocols forward. The language and everything that Indigenous people have today is based because they survived and they thrived.
Indigenous peoples have expressed an incredible amount of patience with explaining their situation and also hosting these events as well. And I'm wondering, where do you find that patience? You may feel like you sound like a broken record over and over again, explaining the same things, but to new audiences all the time. And I'm wondering if the fatigue of that settles in, or where do you find the strength to continue and resolve to help them with the learning process of addressing this colonial past?
It is a learning curve, especially for Indigenous people. One of the things that you'll hear from Indigenous people a lot is when it comes to reconciliation, it appears that the onus is always on Indigenous people. So it's good to look at reconciliation for what it's worth. It is a partnership between two groups to move forward. So in us sharing the history as well as sharing what had happened to Indigenous people and looking at our resiliency and all the stuff that we can survive and have survived and will survive, it's always good to understand that this is going to be a partnership between Canada and Indigenous people within the local territories. And I think the first step that people can utilize to become a good ally and to help that process of reconciliation is become a strong ally is by learning as much as you can about the local people and the territory you're on.
Looking close to home here in the Prince George Clyde area, Shelley Reserve is situated very close in proximity and even overlapping with a lot of industrial activity. We have CN Rail, Canadian National Rail, moving through that land in order to access Shelley across one of the bridges. We pass by pulp mill and forestry industry. Have you felt that the steps towards reconciliation has been taken more seriously by these groups over the last few years than earlier? Or does it kind of look the same?
Yeah. Well, when we say overlapping, especially with the reserves that we were moved onto, which we didn't agree to move to, when we look at the reserve system, a lot of the industry that you see there weren't there when we were there. We didn't land on the railway. We didn't land on the pipeline. We didn't land on the power lines. They landed on us. So while we're moved out to this undesirable land from our homelands, which were downtown Prince George and the surrounding area, we're moved to these undesirable lands. And then industry, as it came through, for some reason, just happened to go through the reserves that we're placed on. So looking at industry now, there are big steps being taken by a lot of industry to include Indigenous people while they move forward with the work that needs to be done to keep bringing energy and infrastructure and transportation to Canadians with the inclusion of Indigenous people now. So those steps are being taken forward. It's going to be one of those trips that there is no end. We're going to walk this path together, and that's what reconciliation is that partnership between two groups of people to make the world a better place for our kids.
This day is an opportunity for healing. I'm kind of curious of what is the power or the significance of having that time specifically so that people have the opportunity to come together, share stories, and heal?
It's when we're looking at, you know, healing in any aspect, there are different levels of healing. If you have a surgery, you're going to have to rest to let your body heal so that it can, you know, do the process that it needs to close the wound up. Right now, we're looking at how do we help the people who have been the most affected by residential school, because everybody thinks the residential school effect basically ended with the students or the survivors who went to these institutions. But there are intergenerational traumas that we see today. So what I think that the process that we have here now for the healing section is to bring those people together to let them know they're not alone and that we're going to get through this together. Because as Indigenous people, the way we survived the harsh climate, the winters, you know, conflicts, was together. You relied on your family, you relied on your neighboring nations, you relied on the people, the guests within your territory, because you all had to work together. And I think we're going back to that traditional point of view on healing by including all of the people, the intergenerational trauma, as well as the survivors and the children or survivors to this event, so that we can figure out what is needed. And the best people to tell us what they need are the people who are experiencing it. The healing aspect, a lot of people don't understand the truth, because they think what happened to one Indigenous group in Canada happened to them all. But we all have our unique experiences, as unique as the territories that we come from. So I think it'd be really good to learn about your local Indigenous group, whether you're in Prince George, which would be Clatley Tene, or if you're in one of the surrounding cities, it would basically be one of the other nations that surround Clatley Tene, one of our sister nations. Learn more about where, you know, where did the people come from? How did they live on the land? How long have they been there? Understand the governance structure, understand the economic structure that we had pre-contact, those basic foundational facts, that would help you get a better understanding of the nation's territory that you're on.
And we also learned from Ian Craig in Prince George, British Columbia, that the First Nations Center at the University of Northern British Columbia is calling upon students, faculty, administration, and the community at large to participate in the creation of 1,000 origami ravens. According to a Japanese legend, anyone who folds 1,000 origami cranes will be granted a wish. The raven is also significant within First Nations cultures. It is a figure that also teaches important lessons and is known to bring light to a world of darkness.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, British Columbia. You are listening to Viewpoints.
And in Smithers, British Columbia, Pamela Hassan had a lengthy conversation with the hereditary chief, Tsikot Ron Hostin. He designed a new totem pole that will be raised in front of Walnut Park Elementary to acknowledge Indian Town in Smithers, British Columbia. The pole is over 15 meters in height and made of a red cedar tree. Tsikot Ron Hostin speaks about the raising of the totem pole and remembers the days of Indian Town.
Each time you lift the pole, one clan comes out, sings their song, and they do their speech, and then the next clan all the way until the five clans have finished their speech and their songs. And then the last one was a bear. The bear is the owner, and they do their last speech and talk about their territory and what this pole represents. The feast will also teach people our culture. That's, I think, the most important part. Indian Town, I witnessed Indian Town. I was just a little toddler when we used to go there. My grandfather had a house there and loaned it to his brother-in-law, and we used to go visit him all the time. We lived in Hagelgate, but we always came to this area here called Kinuskat, top of the swamp.
Yeah.
That's the Indian name for Smithers, Kinuskat, top of the swamp.
Yeah.
Quite a few of my cousins got sent to residential school and the regular villagers, mm-hmm. but my grandfather and grandmother didn't want my brother Frank or my sister Louise to go to residential school, so they sent us out to, we lived out in the Trapper, and just at Buckley Canyon outside of Hazelton there.
Yep.
That's where we were raised up, and when we were little children, we were taught the culture, and we had our own little trap line, rabbit snaring rabbits and grouse and whatnot, when we were little, tiny little guys.
Yeah,
my grandfather, that was probably the last deadfall that was ever used, was at that camp. I witnessed my grandfather trapping a bull moose, and it was quite something. Yeah. So I think on Friday this pole's going to be raised. Be quite the occasion. I hope we have lots of people to witness the raising.
And we also want to let you know that in Sackville, New Brunswick, the Amlagog First Nation is hosting its first ever youth mini powwow on September 30th. That's just outside the village of Dorchester. Last year, on the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, the Fort Folly First Nation hosted a sacred fire. Hundreds of people came from surrounding communities to pay their respects, to ask questions about residential schools and truth and reconciliation, and of course, to climb on the orange shirt bear. This year's powwow is a first for Amlagog and part of a growing number of powwows happening in the Maritimes. Well, that's it for us this week. Thanks to all our journalists, Megan Dooling, Erica Butler, Edward Sweeney, Owen Thompson, Jules Bugiel, Mick Sweetman, Ian Craig, Christina Laurie, and Pamela Hassan. Thanks to our national editors, Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I'm your host and producer, Boris Hassan. Hope you enjoyed the show. Please stay tuned to what follows. Until next week, ciao.
Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.